Welcome to Who Are You, a CSI podcast. I am Raven, and I have seen CSI thrown through around 3 to 4 times.
And I'm Nick. These are my first time experiencing these episodes.
And today we are reviewing Season 4, Episode 10, Coming of Rage. Original air date, December 18th, 2003. Director, Nelson McCormick. Writers, Anthony E. Zeiker, Sarah Goldfinger, and Richard Catalani. And we begin today's episode with shots of the Vegas Strip before we head over to a house being built. So, Nick, what is our Vegas score for today's episode?
Probably should have added them together. It's pretty low. It doesn't feel like it would be low, but it's actually only 20.
Oh, I felt like it was going to be higher. I feel like Vegas was like in the background of a lot.
There's
of
a lot of suburban shots.
There are a lot of
suburban shots. I didn't give them any credit.
Okay. Okay.
Then. And we're not really like in a casino. Like there were no like bonus points. Yeah. So there's only... I mean, I don't think I missed any because I was keeping an eye. Whenever the count is low, I'm always like double checking my notes.
You're like, wait a second, did I miss a scene?
So I got the opening scene. There's a couple other scenes throughout the episode. They actually pretty much stop halfway through the episode because we just end up cutting between like to suburbia. There's like a shot of the high school at one point. There's a bunch of shots of like the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
But yeah. There's never really like a full, like you can't even see the strip in anything in the latter half. A lot of indoor shots at the back half of this episode too.
Yes. So,
yeah.
All right. So with our low Vegas score, we head out to suburbia where this house is being built. And one of the construction workers walks into a room within the house being built, finds a bloody body. We then have Grissom on scene. Jim Brass is already there. Jim Brass lets him know that the person has been dead for over 12 hours, and they're kind of talking about like the motive, like why was this person killed. And Grissom's talking about his, so a thing to note, his pants are down around his
waist.
So Grissom initially is like, well, that signifies maybe a crime of passion, but just the like brutality of it signifies an act of rage.
Yes. They always have these, like, a lot of times they say like crime of passion. They talk about like they'll make a bunch of assumptions about crimes, and I felt like they didn't bring up any of those. Instead they sort of had these different divergent ones. But I do think the idea that the guy has pants around his knees or ankles or whatever it was at the time is probably a big factor in like how you think about the motive for this, but also like the location. So like, you're not in a home.
No,
you're in a place of work. You're in like a random location where you're like, you're meeting somebody up. Did you come upon somebody at random? Like, we don't know that yet. And so, yeah, so there's a little bit more going on here than your standard, like, desire to kill, like, premeditated murder situation.
Yep. So we go to credits. We come back from credits. Jim Brass is talking to the supervisor who's not happy about having his work site shut down. Warwick and Sarah pull up. They go into the room where Grissom is. They, you know, they're talking about the crime scene. Sarah's pointing out that the wound looks like it's a hammerhead. And so then she goes to collect hammers. She's not happy about it. She's like, seriously? And it goes off. Grissom is taking photos. Warwick finds a bloody shoe print, which is going to play a very important...
Yeah.
And brings us to a very interesting scene to me, in my opinion, later on in the episode. But we'll get there in a while.
Yeah.
Sarah is then collecting said hammers, gets hits on in the process. One of the construction workers just can't help but try to put the moves on her. And she, rightfully so, says, like, a murder just happened. Like, I'm not in the mood.
This is what I thought might be up in the running for the title.
Oh, the title?
Episode. Oh. Yeah, it's like nothing like murder
gets
to be Randy. Or Randy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, what a good line. It made me laugh on both watches. So yeah, that's always
it's a good one. I agree. We then have, we go to storyline B. Nick is arriving at a home. David and Vega are already there. A woman is dead from a gunshot wound. We learn that she was breaking up a fight when she was killed. Nick goes over to the husband and because he needs to run a GSR test. And I did note, because we've talked about it quite a bit this season, about how Nick is very understanding and is
friendly,
there for the families buddy. And friendlies. And I was like, where is friendly Nick? Like, he is like immediately judging this guy. And I was like, Nick, this is usually you play the counter to this approach.
I would say that the Nick of these other episodes he would say like, yeah, man, it's just standard procedure. This is going to rule you out and you don't have to worry
yeah,
about it.
Yeah.
You know,
not this one.
I don't know that it's intentional growth. I just think that there's like I don't know. We almost never interact with this character again.
I don't think we do.
And so it's like, I think the idea was like, I'm just gathering evidence here, but because he's a suspect, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Basically. So he's keeping him at arm's length.
Yeah. Yeah. We're back with Grissom and Sarah, and they're with a few officers as well as an adorable bloodhound. Grissom lets the officer who is handling the bloodhound know that Sarah does all the running. So Sarah is going to accompany the officer. It is not going to be Grissom. So they go through a mall. They stop at a few spots where the dog is like picking up the scent, but they ultimately end up outside at a dumpster. And as they're going through the dumpster, Penny, the bloodhound, marks on a silver bag that contains the shirt, which looks like the fabric gripped in the victim's hand, as well as receipts for like earrings and coffee. And I do, because Nick will appreciate this, Gabby was not having these scenes, because when the bloodhound was like finding the scent, it was barking, and Gabby was like, what is this dog inside of my house? Because Gabby is too dumb to realize that dogs on TV are not dogs in our living room.
My dogs also are generally too dumb. I think Lola's pretty good. If the Goobo was around, he would bark his head off.
Yeah. So Gabby was letting me know she was not a fan of Penny the Bloodhound, but I was. Penny is very cute. We're then with Nick with Doc Robbins, and we realize that his victim, her heart took the bullet. That's what killed her. Heart, bullet straight to heart. And it's still in there. So they go to extract it. And they measure the depth. And it's only 4 inches, which is strange, because generally speaking, like normal velocity would be 12 inches.
Yes.
And so the fact that it just like essentially hit her heart and then just stopped and like is just hanging out in her heart is strange.
I want you to know that old school, I wrote down a prediction here.
Oh, I like it.
We had this reenactment already that showed her lying on the ground.
Yes.
And I said, oh, for sure this bullet fell out of the sky. Because we had already established no one really had a gun.
No one had a gun.
Nobody's GS was positive for GSR.
Yeah.
I was like, she was shot by a bullet that seemed to come from nowhere. You hear these things all the time. People fire guns off in the air. They go up, they come down.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I was slowly going slow. It's not deep enough. I was like, for sure this bullet fell out of the sky. And then like immediately after, I think it's the next scene or there's maybe one scene in between, they continue to talk about this and test this, and I was like, I just rewrote my note. Oh yeah, for sure.
You were like,
this bullet fell out of the sky.
I thought we were gonna what happened.
So spoiler alert, it does. We were gonna find out way earlier.
I thought we were gonna
figure it out ahead of this.
There was
gonna be something else to do. Yeah.
Nope. We go through some steps. So we then have one of many scenes with funky music going on. There's a lot of processing evidence scenes with just like funky like boop, boop, music going on. So in this one, Warwick is swabbing hammers, and we learn that one of the hammers does test positive for blood, and that hammer belongs to Gregory Kurtwell. So, but before we meet Gregory Kurtwell, Sarah is with Archie. They're going over the mall footage. And look at that. Amazingly, they find the girl and the sweater.
Yeah.
And they get a perfect, clear security footage shot of her face. Perfectly clear. I was like, no, that was not happening in 2003.
Well, the only thing I could think is they had the receipt from the store of the thing being purchased. And they, you know, so they're narrowed down to the footage from like a 1 hour window.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like there would be a camera probably there, because that is the kind of place that people go to steal things.
Yeah.
But it's a very, I don't know, the average security camera in any store is so much worse than it needs to be, especially 20 years ago.
The quality of the shot is way too good. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that they couldn't pinpoint like a time frame because they had the receipts. There's no way that the camera technology was that good for it to be that clear.
They would just pay for it if it existed. Like,
yeah,
this is a checkbox moment, not a cost cutting moment. This was just black and white TV camera footage, right?
Warwick enters, and this is where he confirms that he found blood on the hammer, which brings us to Jim Brass and Warwick with Gregory Kurtwell, who is my spot.
Oh yes.
So This is Brian Austin Green.
Yep.
And I will say that the thing that I know him most for is being the ex-husband of Megan Fox.
Okay. I concur, because I was going to say, I'm probably going to have to say that one of the biggest reasons I really know who Brian Austin Green is because he was dating Megan Fox. Now, I think through that relationship, because I never watched 90210.
Yeah.
It is before my time.
Same, exactly.
But I know who's on 90210, because I think I would be like, oh, Brian Austin Green, former 90210 cast member, dating Megan, that's like height of like tabloid time.
Yeah.
I used to work in a grocery store, and there would be like old tabloids in the break room. But I know him.
23 episodes of Terminator.
Yeah, I know him from the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Okay, that's yeah.
He's a major character in that TV show, and I didn't even know it was Brian Austin Green. I was like, oh, that's the Terminator guy. And I looked up, and I said, oh yeah, that is Brian Austin Green. That's the guy who dated Megan Fox. He was in 90210, wasn't he? That was my exact thought process. So sorry, Brian Austin Green. I don't know. Maybe you prefer it this way. You're known for something other than 90210. But to us, you were there. And unfortunately, it did not work out between you and Megan Fox. I believe she's with Machine Gun Kelly now. Is that...
They are no longer together.
Oh, okay.
She's very pregnant with his child, though.
Oh, okay, so very recently.
Yeah. They've been back and forth. So supposedly the most recent breakup is she found incriminating evidence on his phone that he was cheating on her. So
it happens.
So we have Jim Brassenborg talking to Gregory Curtwell, aka Brian Austin Green, and he's confused because he thinks that he's just here to collect his hammer. He's not sure why this is turning into like a legitimate interrogation. Maybe they do and they just don't show it, but they don't read him his Miranda rights. Like he seems like, what? I was just here to pick up my hammer. And now you're like asking me all these questions.
He's not the sharpest nail in the shed.
He is not. So he does tell them that he was fishing over the weekend. And as they're continuing to question him, they're like, do you know who this girl is? And they hold up the dressing room footage. And he's like, yeah, that's my younger sister, Ashley. Like, why are you asking?
What does this have to do with the dead body?
Yeah, like, what does this have to do with my hammer and this dead body? Like, what are we talking about? So we cut to Sarah with Ashley. We learn that her...
Can I interject one thing here?
Yeah.
So often, this show has a way of just blindly believing people who aren't the real murderer when they say something like, they'd be like, oh, yeah, he clearly didn't know we were asking him about this murder when we showed him a picture of his sister, so he must be innocent.
Yeah.
They like move on from a suspect that was like a red herring, but they hold on him for a long time.
They do. They don't give this one up for a while.
It's just like sometimes they feel like they give up the goose too easily with some of these other people. They're like, oh, we confirmed his alibi. Like they'll just like throw it away as a one liner later.
Nope, not this one. So we have Sarah with Ashley. We learn that her parents died in a car accident several years earlier, so her brother is now her legal guardian.
My parents died in a car accident 4 years ago.
I'm very sorry. Your brother Gregory is your guardian, right?
Yeah.
And he left you alone all weekend?
He goes away a lot.
Okay. Why don't you tell me what happened last night?
Jim Brassenborg are watching this entire conversation, and she, in talking to Sarah, admits to cutting through the construction site, and that's where she encountered Brian Haddock, who she goes to school with. He told her that he was missing a cat. She went to go help him. He assaulted her. A man attacked Brian. She ran away. And Sarah does appear to be genuinely sympathetic to her.
Yeah.
But she does bring up, like, okay, you know, you're saying all this happened, but then, like, you went shopping.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, well, he was all over me. I just needed to, like, get new clothes and get him off of me. And then Sarah's like, okay, like, that I can understand, but you also got coffee and earrings.
Yeah. I feel like Sarah kind of giving away the playing their hand, the evidence here.
A little bit.
She was sort of leading the witness, if you were sort of speaking.
Yeah.
Letting her know where she could have easily just asked, like, well, did you go anywhere?
Yeah, did you go anywhere
afterwards? Did you go straight home?
Yeah.
And let her tell a lie before letting her know that you know that she went to the mall
yeah.
and spent this money that I guess they haven't figured that part out yet. But yeah, but like, yeah, and that has a lot to do with Sarah not thinking of her as a as anything other than a victim.
Other than a victim, oh, correct. And Jim Brass, in watching this, thinks that she is covering for her brother. So as Nick mentioned, they're not giving up on the brother at this stage. Jim Brass is like, she's covering for the brother. We now have Grissom with Doc Robbins, and we learn that the initial blows to the victim were to the victim's head. But as they continued, his spinal cord was severed, but they kept hitting him even after he passed away. He had a lot of wounds post-mortem. So he had died, and they just like kept beating him up.
Wailing
on him. And Doc Robbins points out, though, that the victim, Brian, has a pattern on his hand. So he took some samples. He sent those off to Greg Sanders. We then have Grissom with Brian's parents. They don't recognize Ashley. They show Grissom shows them a picture of her, and they're like, no, we don't know. And I just thought this entire exchange, I know it's not supposed to be funny, but I thought this entire exchange, not the entire exchange, this part of the exchange was funny, because they're explaining to Grissom that while their son now had been doing better, was like on the right track and had a job and was getting paid under the table beforehand, he was getting out of hand. And you know how he was getting out of hand? By smoking the marijuana and staying out late. And you know what the final thing was? He went and he got his nipple pierced. And that was it. That was the final straw.
This is like the all-star parroting happens in this episode of all forms. There's just like a variety of like parent-child relationships in this episode. And they're all very stereotypical, but probably also very true.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think that this is inaccurate. I think it's I find it humorous because I do think that there are parents out there that think that one of the worst things that their child could do is get their nipple pierced.
Especially at like this time. I don't know. Like, I think it's because it's closer to when we were children.
Yeah.
But like we had a pulse of like what the helicopter parent paranoia cycle of the time was. And yeah, like people would get grounded for going to Claire's and getting their ears pierced.
Oh, for sure. Oh yeah, yeah. You know, 100%.
It's like this is only like 5 years later.
Yeah. Know? My mom, I mean, she didn't try to ground me. I'm trying to remember what the conversation was, because I was 19 or 20, maybe even 21. I was still living at home. I think that was it. I think I was still living at home, but I was like 19 or 20 or 21. And I went to go get my lip pierced. And my mom was like, I forbid you. And I literally was like, what are you going to do? Like, I was like, I am an adult. Like, what are you going to do?
I was like, people would like come home with, you know, half their head shaved and blue hair from their friend's house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then their parents would flip out. And
see, my mom was fine with that, because this was when I had my mohawk and I had my colored hair. That she didn't care about. But having my lip pierced, she was not.
Yeah.
She was not cool with.
I just think that, like, yeah. So people just react to different things. But yeah, there's some other, like, class A parroting that I have a lot to say about later.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We'll definitely get there. We have a few instances of it. So we then have Nick with Bobby, and we learn that neither the husband or the ex-boyfriend have GSR on their hands. And this is kind of the start of further explanation of like what slowed down this bullet. Why was the depth only 4 inches? And so
I do like that they're just telling us now that those guys don't have GSR in their hands, since this is like a field test that they do in seconds.
No. I was hoping that this was gonna be pertinent, and this is perfectly pertinent. So, as I've mentioned in other episodes, I watched the first 48, and I think it is pretty real time. So this is funny, but I wanted to tell this story because I was like, oh, because it comes up. Do I tell it now? I'm gonna tell it now. Okay,
tell it now.
So this first 48, like, legit happened in real life story connected so well with this episode. I was like, whoa. So I was watching an episode of the first 48, and they had a suspect, and they were pretty sure that he was the gunman. And so, but they like really didn't have good evidence at this stage of the game. And so one of the detectives are like talking outside of the interrogation room. And one of the detectives is like, do you think he knows, like, how GSR tests work?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the main detective was like, oh, all right, you want to, like, like bait and switch them kind of thing. And they were just like, look, let's see, you know. So they go in and they swab his hand. So I do think maybe it takes longer than we think, because they go and they swab his hand, and the guy's like, hey, give me a few minutes. And he leaves and he goes back in and tells the guy that he tested positive for GSR, but they don't have the results of the GSR test.
Yeah.
So they go back in and they're like, hey, you tested positive for GSR. And he broke down. And he admitted to doing the shooting. So again, friends, if you're being interrogated by police in the U.S., I literally cannot speak to other countries because I don't tend to watch crime related shows based in other countries. In the U.S., the police are legally allowed to lie to you in order to get a confession out of
yes.
you. They can say whatever they want.
Yep. They can say, we have you on video.
They can say, we have you on video. They can say, this, you know, this DNA test came back and it was you. They don't have to tell you the truth. Which is why you need a lawyer and not just like take everything at face value. The police.
Yeah. The first thing your lawyer is going to say is, can I see the video?
Can I see the video?
Because now you have to show it to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is my client under arrest? No. Okay. We're leaving. Oh, he's under arrest. Okay. Now you have to show me the evidence.
Yeah. So I just wanted to tell that story. Cause as I was watching, cause I watched this episode and then watched the first 48 and then watched the second watch through of this. And I was like, oh man, I hope this comes
yes.
up.
Later I was very confused on the tact of what I was like later on. There's a test.
Yeah.
We'll get to it. They're faking it. They're lying to the person.
Yes.
And they had that conversation. Do you think they know how a DNA test works? And I was like, wait, what?
And literally the exact same thing happened on the first 48.
I was like, oh, they're lying.
They know how GSR test works? I was like, snap. So
we'll talk about that scene anyways, because I think it's the worst scene in the whole show.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll get there in a bit. So we then have work. He walks into where Greg Sanders is. We learn that the trace taken from the victim's hand does not match Gregory or Ashley. So they're like, okay, we need, like, we're other people at play here. So Grissom, Sarah, and Work are back at the scene. They're kind of like walking through the attack and like where the victim would have been positioned. And in so doing, they realize that there is three separate sets of cast off. And this leads Grissom to think that there were three hammers. And there was three attackers.
Dun, dun, dun. It's a bit of a jump, but it's not a bad one.
No, it's not a terrible one. We then return to storyline B. Nick finds Catherine doing some filing paperwork. I'm not quite sure. Asks if she wants to do real work, aka cooking.
I was thinking of the case reviews that Grissom had before and wondered if she was supposed to be doing some of those. Remember that when he went off to the...
Yeah.
Left all his case reviews?
Yeah. And so... We then have, we're back to the funky music. Catherine is cooking, quote unquote, aka making gelatin. And Nick is prepping the bullets. Catherine wheels the gelatin into the room with Nick and Bobby. And they measure velocity and penetration. I did laugh at this scene. Because there was a little like tee-hee
yeah.
moment about 12 inches of penetration. And I,
and something
again, I'm a child sometimes, and I thought it was funny, and I literally put tee hee in my notes because I was like,
yeah, 12, I think Catherine was like 12 inches, and that's at a full load.
Yeah.
Or that's blowing a full load or something.
I thought it was funny. But as they're doing the test, they realize that it was 40%, like 40% velocity led to the 4 inches of depth, which is 550 feet per second. So then Bobby and Nick are talking through the math to try to figure out how, you know, A, like how long a 9mm bullet could travel for, because there's gravity, right? Like it's gonna get pulled to the ground. And so Nick is like, could it even, if you shot it, you know, in a straight line, could it even go that far to get to that velocity? And this is where Bobby's like, no, not really. And Bobby shows, like, if you shoot it up at an angle, that the distance can go much further. And so this is where we learned, and I think, Nick, you already pointed this out.
Yeah.
Nick points out that he assumed that she was standing when she was shot. But now he's like, wait a second, she wasn't.
They measure the angle of entry, 85 degrees, which is basically straight on if you think about. Saying your hand straight out would be 90 degrees, so just a little off from there. And that was a great use of a protractor and sign earlier in the episode. But yeah, so now they're continuing with some mapping here. Yeah, so continue. Yeah, so that Nick was assuming they were standing.
Yeah, and but then has to factor in that, you know, bullets are predictable. Bullets are going to, like, behave in the way that they're going to behave. People are not. And so maybe she was not standing. But so before...
I'm going to go on a little math tangent here.
Yeah, go for it.
So obviously the idea is, like, she's laying on the ground, the bullet comes down, hits her. There's a couple of things that happen with this math. So the first thing to think of, to go back to the beginning, if you shoot a bullet straight, it's traveling at some velocity out of the gun. Mm-hmm. It's traveling straight. It's being slowed down by the air that it's having to push aside the entire way it's traveling. And we do a lot to try to minimize that, to make bullets go really fast and stay really fast and shoot really far. But this is good. Gun, it's a handgun, not designed to shoot very far,
right?
But like the same thing that, like, if you dropped a rock and it fell and hit the ground, the same number amount of time that it would take for that rock to fall and hit the ground about is what it's going to take this bullet to hit the ground. The question is, how far forward does it go during that time as it, you know, gets shot out at a very high speed and then slows down? When you shoot it up at an angle, like just like if you threw a baseball to somebody or someone, right, or a football, it kind of goes up in an arc and comes down. In a perfect vacuum, if you threw an object, if you shot an object up at an angle, it has what we call a ballistic trajectory. When it hits the ground, it will be going the same speed it was going when it left the gun.
Okay.
In real life, what will happen is it will have some terminal velocity where the acceleration of gravity and the air resistance equal out. And all objects you drop have some kind of terminal velocity. So it may not be going, because they tend to leave the gun going really fast and then slow down really quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be coming down some different angle. They then try to use the speed that they think it hit based on how far it penetrated the gel to determine a shot radius.
Yes.
That part would not work the way they did it. Okay. Because it where it came down is not a function of, like, speed and time. It has, you have to count for all those other things into consideration. And because things have a terminal velocity, if that's its like when it hits the ground, it should be going basically as fast as it was going when it left the gun, except it won't because of air will slow it down.
Yeah, yeah.
No matter how far away you were, like when it hits the ground, it should basically be going the same speed. Okay. Now, the angle will determine how far it went. So like the area, search area should have been much broader. So I applaud them for using some great math throughout this episode.
Yeah.
They just dropped the ball really hard here. But you can kind of figure these things out with a lot of other little bits and pieces.
Yeah, yeah.
However, it's super important that this is a real thing that happens. There are real people who have died because bullets have fallen out of the sky and killed them.
Yes. Oh, 100%.
For people who are not trying to shoot them. And they'll talk about it more later. But it is very illegal to do. You have to be super careful. And that's why gun ranges do a lot to try to keep bullets from going anywhere. It was funny. They started to draw this thing. It's like, oh, we could figure out it was exactly 1,800 meters away, feet away. I was like, no, you can't. That's not how that works. That's not how that math works. I was like, that's a good try. You could probably get a donut-shaped space to look in, but you would not get a line. No, it was kind of funny.
Yeah, that's fair. We're then with Jim Brass and Grissom, a little bit of a walk and talk. They go into a room where Warwick is. He's talking about the shoe prints or the shoe print that they pulled, and it's from a skater shoe, which leads them to think, like, well, Ash is in high school. Maybe this is from another student at the high school. So they pop on over.
The victim was in the high school too.
Yes, the victim was in the high school too. So they pop on over to the high school. Now they're in the auditorium and they're just checking out shoes, and Warwick is just making buddy-buddy with the students. Like, hey, you play basketball? Like, just like, weird, like, so strange. Well,
I think he's checking out all their shoes, right?
He is checking out all their shoes, but I just, I don't know. The small talk was strange to me. And the principal and Jim Brass are talking, and fairly, the principal's like, we're really close to a legal search here. We're like, we're really on the cusp.
Walking a tight line.
Walking a tight line here. And in comes a dad / attorney who is like, no, you cannot do this. You are violating these students' rights. Their parents need to be here. I don't know what's going on. And so after a bit, not a physical tussle, but a tussle of words, he takes his son and goes and essentially forces the principal to excuse all the other kids whose parents aren't there. So
all the kids whose parents are there can leave.
Yes.
Everyone else like can leave once their parents show up to take them away.
Yeah.
Presumably this is during school hours.
That's my understanding.
Yeah, because they have to be at school during school hours. If it's after school, they'd be free to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the kids leave, except essentially one. And coincidentally,
There was a few,
but not many. Yeah. And he's sitting pretty much by himself.
Yep.
Has blood on his shoes. And we learn that this is Benny. And the reason that Benny's dad is not there is because his dad is at home drunk.
And you could also see it's the shoe that Warwick
identified. It's very obviously the shoe that Warwick printed. So then Jibras and Warwick are with Benny and Benny's dad at their home. And this is the scene. Essentially, his dad is letting them do whatever. Like, he's like, like, my son is kind of a piece of crud, so do whatever you want to do.
The dad is also clearly drunk, and they have a whole conversation about let them argue, you know, whatever. Because, like, if he's not, if they come to his house and he's drunk, they can't get his permission to interrogate his son, to search his house, to do any of that. He's not in a good mind. And the reason this bothers me is, like, you're talking about a capital murder case here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
This is a fruit from the poison tree problem.
Right.
If this search, if these conversations become inadmissible and anything you get from this search becomes inadmissible, you might have no case whatsoever.
Right. Yeah.
And I was really, really thinking that lawyer dad's kid was going to be one of the kids at the end.
Oh, yeah.
It was not. But if he was, he would be all over this. Because he also told them his dad was drunk before they brought him there, which could come out in a deposition in a trial.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? And and so, so this is a, I'm going to call it here. Like, we never get to see the resolution. This kid is not going to jail.
Oh, all right. Hot takes.
Much to his chagrin, apparently.
As later. We'll find out in a little bit.
I guess he could plead guilty and then it won't matter. But yeah, that's like this evidence would definitely all get thrown out in a real murder trial. Because you'd have, it would be a high profile. We'd have real.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, this would be a major. Yeah, this would be, this would bring a
national news story.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So yeah, this is a scene where they perform the fake DNA test on Benny's shoe. So what they do is they do test for blood. That's the test that they run.
Yeah.
What they tell Benny is that their test can confirm that it is Brian's blood on the shoe. That it cannot do.
First time watching this, I was like, what? You can't do that. The second time, I was like, oh, that was the goal.
That was the goal.
Because I think I caught the line about, like, how do you think the DNA test worked on the second watch through before they did it. And the second time, I was like, I didn't quite get it. Like, you know what I mean? The first time. The second time, I had the context of what they were going to do. So I was like, oh, I see.
Yeah, you're like, I get it now.
And then, then they get permission to search the whole friggin' house.
Yep. So before they search the house, though, Benny admits to going to the construction site, but he just, you know, he just goes there to hang out. He just, like, happened upon the body, no big deal. And then I think that's kind of what prompts Warwick to be like, can we look around the rest of the house? And the dad's like, yeah, do whatever you want. So he starts to look around.
Did we talk about the $145 game system yet?
$125.
$25 game system. Because it's important later. Yeah.
Yes.
That's why his dad thinks the cops are there at first. Because he must have stolen the Xbox.
He thinks he's stolen the Xbox. Yeah, they go in the room and they see the Xbox, $125 Xbox. They see these little, like, plastic rings, some CDs. And then there's just, like, a score of smashed watermelons and a hammer as well. So, like, that's suspicious. So Jibras is with Benny, and he has waived the right to have a parent or advocate there, which... Can you do that as a child?
I don't think as a child you can waive your advocate.
I don't think you can waive your advocate.
I think your advocate can advocate for you and have your parents waived, although they're probably allowed to be in the other room.
Right.
And it obviously doesn't sound like his dad would want to be.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. I would love to hear from somebody if they know how this works, but you can waive a lot of things as an adult, but the whole point is you are a child.
You're a child.
And you cannot have these things waived.
I think so too. So, but in this instance, they can. So we learn in this interaction that, you know, Benny's a friendly guy. He knew Ashley, whatever. He knows a lot of people, no big deal. And Jibras is coming at the angle of, like, hey, we got enough evidence to show that you're involved, but we know you're not the only one.
No. So why don't you turn over Gregory still? They're still on Ashley's brother.
Gregory. So he's like, why don't you help yourself and, you know, tell us who else was there, what happened. He's not a snitch, though. He doesn't care about going to juvie. His dad's not there. He has cable. They're going to feed him. Sweet. Send me to juvie.
You have a new Xbox at home, kid. I mean, come on.
You're not going to have the Xbox in juvie. So we then have Grissom and Greg Sanders. They walk into where Warwick and Sarah are. Greg Sanders knows what those little rubber bands are. They're for braces. I knew immediately because I had those rubber bands, and I chose to have them in obnoxious colors because I was obnoxious.
You mean in colors?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had them different colors when I had my braces. And now I need to get the stupid Invisalign thing because the braces didn't quite...
Didn't go all the way.
No, it didn't quite go all the way. But I had genetically pain in the butt teeth. My brother has like perfect teeth. Perfect genetic. Everything is perfectly straight and where it should be. My mouth was like, no, we're not doing that.
You're I did Invisalign that. During the pandemic. I could not have timed it better.
Oh, that's... Oh, man.
Literally. But it's really not that bad. I had like a... I guess I was like grinding my teeth at night, and my top teeth, bottom teeth are making my teeth loose. And they're like, yeah, you got to move your jaw around or you're going to lose your teeth.
Yeah.
And so they're like, oh, while we're there, we're going to straighten everything in your mouth. I was like, oh, okay. I don't really need you to do that. They're like, honestly, we basically are going to put your mouth into that, you know, into the perfect situation so that you don't ever have this problem again. I was like, okay. And I was like, sure.
And so as they... Or talking about the braces, Grissom's like, hold on a second. Someone having braces could account for the strange patterns that are on the victim's hand.
Yeah, because he punched him in the mouth kind of idea. Punched him in the mouth,
yes. And this was such a throwback, I did have to laugh. So as they're going through the CDs, it's from like C&D Music Club. And Grissom's like, what's that? And they're like, the 12 CDs a month. And I was like, oh man, I remember how much this was pushed when Columbia we were younger. Music
Records or whatever. Yes.
So I did have a little bit of a giggle flashback to that one.
Yeah. I think several times in my household this scam was attempted.
Yeah, I don't think we ever fell for it.
I think the first time was with cassette tapes.
I feel like I filled out the form multiple times, but never actually sent it in.
I was not a big music listener. I still am not really to this day, but I like basically didn't listen to music until I was like 14 years old. And so I was never that big on it. But my older brother is very, very big into listening to music. Although now all he listens to are podcasts, but
it's all I listen to. So no judgment. No, I do. I will say I occasionally listen to music, but vastly listen to podcasts. Yeah,
he had the Walkman, so he was always getting CDs and he was going to Newberry Comics on Newberry Street.
We'll talk about a Walkman in a little bit.
Yeah.
The Walkman comes into play here. But we learned that the DJ in this instance is a one Aaron Gilbert. So before we meet little Aaron Gilbert, Nick and Vega are with a mom, and she is letting them know that her neighbor Johnny was shooting his gun like the day before or something, you know, and that she went out there and yelled at him. So they go to talk to Johnny, and he's like, hey, I just shot it one time. Come to find out, one time means the entire barrel. He shot the gun 10 times. And as Nick is looking at the target in his backyard, he's like, there's only 9 holes in this target. And you shot 10 bullets. And he's like, oh, I must have missed one. And Nick was like, no, you didn't. You just happened to murder somebody.
I do like that. He just like some of those bullets were like on the fringe. But the idea that like he's got this target, he's never shot it before in his whole life.
Never shot it before.
It looks really old. It's got 9 holes in it. And Nick immediately thought is like, nope, instead of missing this once, you clearly, you know, like... Should you take the gun, tell the guy not to leave town, you know, like we're going to have to do some, we think, you know.
No, they arrest him.
But the acceleration, I think, is a big part of this is being the B plot. And like, we're going to get back to the main story.
Yeah, they're like, we got to wrap this up so we can get back to storyline A. So that is the end of storyline B. They arrest Johnny, take him into custody. And it's a nice little lesson about why you should not fire guns in populated areas, which is true story. So then we have Jim Brass and Warwick. They're back at the high school. They're talking to Aaron, and Sarah's there too. And then a boy comes around the corner with braces. So now Jim Brass
punk
is talking.
Little kid, by the way.
Yeah, punk little kid.
He's I forget what the exact dialogue is, but yeah, he's not.
He's like, let's go, bro, or something. Yeah. He says something weird.
He's like the little brother.
And he's a tiny, like a tiny. Yeah, I'm like he's an itter bitter.
So he looks like a Hanson child.
Yeah,
he's got this bleach blonde hair. Or whatever.
I mean, it was the look. And then we have Jim Brass with Aaron again. No parent, no advocate, just him and a kid in an interrogation room. And we learn that he has a brand new Walkman that also cost $125. So this is strange. We have Benny with his $125 Xbox. We have Aaron with his $125 Walkman.
What I actually think is strange is that these two children went to a mall and one of them found an Xbox for $125.
How did you find an Xbox? One of them
somehow spent $125 on a Walkman.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, there was a point
where Walkmans were $125 and it was not when Xboxes were $125.
No, agree. Those, they did not intersect. I agree entirely. During this time, work is with Jared, the younger brother, and thankfully an advocate. Because I guess he's young enough that they're like, well, we really probably shouldn't talk to him without an advocate. So he has an advocate who says nothing and does nothing. So thanks, advocate. You really stepped up to the plate here. But he has a nice little cut on his lip. And Warwick points out that those braces hold some DNA. And his DNA matches the DNA that was pulled off of the victim.
I also like that inevitably the victim punched the littlest person.
Yes. When you're being attacked, the smallest one.
Just like swing at the scrawniest little dude.
So then we have the team talking and they realize that they have three hammers, but they have four suspects. And they're trying to figure out was the mode of robbery, because so far, all of the people that they have been able to track down and think are suspects all bought something worth $125. And so they're like, okay. And then they tie it back to the fact that the victim, Brian, was getting paid $500 every 2 weeks under the table. So they're like, okay, if there's four suspects, like, where's the other $125? Sarah goes, wait a second.
I love that this was like the
total took up a to moment to figure out. It took a moment.
Like, I like that their first thought wasn't, oh, it's Ashley. Their thought was, oh, she bought $125. She said, it must be her.
Yeah.
Not like, it's the other person who we know is there.
Yeah. So Sarah's back with Ashley in interrogation, and they have shown that her print is in Brian's blood on the money that she used to make a purchase.
Yeah.
And so they're like, and she's trying to be like,
Was it just money? I think it was the little kid's.
The little kid's money, kid's
money that was in his room.
Yes, because he had a stash of money still.
Didn't go out and buy something.
He was
saving up for college.
He was saving up for college. He was trying to be responsible, fiscally responsible. And she's trying to say, at first still kind of trying to play the victim, and Sarah's not having it. Sarah's like, I'm tired of the victim act, Ashley, drop it. And then she shifts. Ashley shifts and kind of like becomes like her true self. I don't know. And explains that she used to be like buds with Brian, but then he got too good for them. Like when he cleaned up his act and he stopped getting his nipples pierced. And
yes. Hanging out with him. Yeah, he stopped smoking pot and getting his nipples pierced. Yeah. And he got a job.
Yeah.
How could he betray us?
How could he betray them? And
me and these little kids that I hang out with. Because she like always came off to me as like a senior. Some of these kids are like really pretty young. Like Brian seemed like he was around her age.
Yeah.
But everyone else seemed like they're pretty young.
Yeah. Yeah. She definitely seemed from the flashbacks to be kind of the ringleader in this situation. And Sarah is almost scolding her in a sense, telling her, reminding her, like, do you know how often that rape is not reported because the victims are afraid that someone's not going to believe them? And here you are like, falsely accusing Brian of rape. And she's like, oh, well, that's what I counted on. Like, I counted on, you know, people not, you know, like,
yeah,
I'm not quite sure, but
like, I think the idea was like, they would assume they wouldn't look into any it.
Yeah. They wouldn't look into
a girl out there.
Yeah.
You know, who.
Yeah. Was willing to come forward. We're not going to.
Like, they would never track her down. At the end of the day, I will say, for as coy and smart as she is, get a lawyer. What the heck are you doing?
Get a lawyer. And also
telling them that you murdered this guy.
And also, so this ends with Sarah saying, you know, we're going to try you as an adult, and Ashley saying, fine, yeah, but I'll put some barrettes in my hair and, you know, play the woe is me, my parents died, and I'm like the saddest little girl in the world.
Also probably still tell the, you know, he was, you know, raping me, and these kids just happened to be there.
Just happened to be there and helped me out.
They grabbed a bunch of hammers and hit him with it.
But here's another little nugget from the first 24. They tape interrogations.
Yeah.
You saying that you're going to like play the sad little girl and trick the jury can be played in court.
But But it doesn't make good television if you don't say it on camera.
But that is the end of our episode. So, Nick, what did you think about today's episode?
I like today's episode. It was pretty good. Held up okay on a rewatch. Okay, I ended up at 3.5.
Okay.
I think it's a pretty strong 3.5 in a rewatch. I will say, I was kind of looking back on it and thinking, like, I feel like they did maybe too good of a job of spreading out the CSIs or just a lot of scenes with, like, victims that, like, I was like, it felt like half of the cast was barely in this episode.
It did. It felt,
but they all were.
They all were. I mean, Catherine was barely.
She has the shortest stint. But even Kristen, he's not in all that much of this episode. Warwick's not really in all that much of this episode. It's like Nick is in a lot of it. You know, I guess Warwick's in a good amount. I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't mean everyone's kind of in and out of it. But in a good way. Like, it means they did a good job.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, funny enough, I mean, I feel like we've been diverging a little bit, and then in the last few episodes we've been agreeing. I'm also gonna get it a 3.5. Good episode, had the entire cast. Obviously would have liked a little bit more Warwick, a little bit more Catherine, but everybody was included. There was definitely some, like, moments between Grissom and Sarah that I was like, oh, this is like dropping some little, like, there's just sort of things where Kristen's like, oh, I know you would say that, and oh, you know, like, just things that I'm like, this seems maybe slightly inappropriate given the, like, the will they won't they thing kind of going on here at the moment. So, like, there's like a little bit of backstory, and it was nice to, like, see Nick being out there on his own and, like, carrying a case.
They missed a chance to have another pin me against the wall moment.
They did. That didn't happen. So, yeah, I, you know, two storylines. Both storylines were fine. Like, the B storyline was, like, it was fine. It was a B storyline. It was a little weird. Yeah. I liked that, like, Bobby was well involved. I like when they get the lab people involved.
Yeah.
I do. Greg was, I enjoy it,
flashing a pan, but he contributed.
He contributed. And, yeah, both storylines were decent. It moved at a good pace. The rewatch was fine. I don't know if you, like, I wouldn't say, like, you have to rewatch this one, but it's not a bad rewatch. You can rewatch it. It's rewatchable. And so I'm giving it a 3.5. I'm saying it's pretty good. Pretty good. So,
yeah,
we'll see how we feel next
week. B-. This was
B-.
Right? It's in that B- category. B-. 3.5 GPA, right? Something like that.
So, yeah. We'll see what we think when we return next week to review season 4, episode 11, 11 Angry Jurors. But otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
No spoilers.
No spoilers.